for independent people.
Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Kleanna Lightborn.
And I'm Eric Newton. Today we'll get a Troy news update from Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter.
Then we have another episode of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics with Dr. David Borton.
Afterwards, we'll be joined by Sarah Berger and Bruce Roeder to talk about the Museum of Political Corruption, as well as Dan Pfeiffer to talk about the ACLU. Let's go into some headlines.
The TSA's Office of Inspection has documented more than 200 cases of air marshals allegedly misusing firearms or misbehaving with guns between roughly 2005 and 2017. The cases ranged from seemingly mundane issues like leaving loaded guns in the airport bathroom, such as improper storage of weapons, and situations where air marshals allegedly jeopardized public safety.
President Donald Trump is expected to grant new authority to U.S. troops on the southwest border with Mexico to protect Customs and Border Protection personnel from migrants if they engage in violence, according to two defense officials and another U.S. official directly familiar with the plans. An additional administration official tells CNN that the authority will also authorize protection of federal property. There are 5,800 to 5,900 troops assigned to the border mission.
According to the imaging from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, plumes of smoke from the massive campfire and other wildfires have traveled more than 3,000 miles in a long arc from California to the northeast U.S. and even out into the Atlantic. The campfire, which has been raging in North California since mid-November, has killed at least 79 people and burned more than 151,000 acres, and have put others at risk of suffocating due to the smoke and ash from the fire.
Federal prosecutors have asked a federal judge in Manhattan to sentence SUNY Polytechnic Institute founder Elaine Calieros to a, quote, substantial terms of imprisonment, but below sentencing guidelines that technically could put him away for up to 14 years. Calieros faces sentencing on December 11th for his conviction in July on all counts in his bid-rigging trial.
Dan Dwyer, a Democrat in his third term, died early Tuesday at age 84 after a battle with cancer. Dwyer was a former Air Force pilot and longtime employee of Pan American Airways and Rensselaer County Mayor. He was first elected in 2005. Dan Dwyer's replacement was sworn in today.
General Electric Co. has brought former GE Vice Chairman John Rice out of retirement to serve as chairman of its GE Gas Power business and has selected Russell Stokes, current GE Power CEO, for the CEO position at its GE Power portfolio business.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org and follow us on Instagram or Twitter at mediasanctuary.com and facebook.com. And for our regular listeners, you'll know that at this point in the show, we'd usually be joined live by Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here with us tonight. He's covering a city council budget meeting. But that'll be great content for our next meeting with him. And in the meantime, he did have the decency to do a pre-recorded segment for us. So let's go to that now.
I guess first I'll start with an update on the Mount Ida Lake Dam project. Mm-hmm. This just briefly is a dam that is on the Postenkill, kind of right where Route 2 and Pauling Ave meet. And a couple of months ago, an engineering firm retained by the city was doing some sort of kind of a review of the dam in preparation to do work on the abutments of the dam, the sort of sides of the dam that were damaged a number of years ago during Hurricane Irene. And when they were doing that review, they discovered, much to their chagrin, that the spanning timbers, or the middle part of the dam, basically was cracked or damaged in some way. And that it was basically in danger of potential collapse over the next year, you know, especially if there were some sort of extreme weather event or sort of a flood or something of that nature. So what they, the plan that they eventually arrived at, and which was later approved by DEC, the state, was to basically cut a hole in the dam. Mm. So the water, what will happen if they cut a hole in the dam, the theory is that this releases pressure on the dam. And so that's, it's less likely in, especially in the event of extreme weather or extreme kind of rush of water or whatever, it won't give way, or it's less likely to give way. But that's not a permanent solution. And that's some of what was gotten into last week. So last week, the city held the first of what are promised to be basically monthly meetings, kind of overseen by the city council to kind of update the public on what's happening with that project. Because, you know, given the emergency nature, I think it caught a lot of people off guard, and their neighbors have a number of concerns. And one big concern, and I say it is an aesthetic concern, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's not serious, is just that Ida Lake, which is sort of kind of created because of this dam almost, will essentially be drained probably once the hole is cut in the dam. And Ida Lake is sort of, it looks nice, and you know, people can paddle on it, and it's
beloved.
It's beloved, right? And it's basically historic at this point. I mean, it's been there for, I think, a century at this point. So people are concerned about that. And so the deputy mayor last week, Monica Krzyzewski, and Chris Whalen, the superintendent of public utilities, gave an update on all this stuff. And maybe the biggest news from last week is that the city has at this point submitted an application for the temporary removal or the temporary cutting a hole in the middle of dam with the state. And they're expecting to hear back now-ish. To my knowledge, they haven't heard back, but, you know, I can check, you know, later today. Actually, I'm going to follow up on that. If it is approved, the city expects that it's going to have certain conditions on it in terms of, like, how long they have to complete the work, and also how long they have to come up with a more permanent solution. But deconstruction work could start as early as the first week of December, which is quite soon. One of the concerns for the state, again, these are all details that sort of came out last week at the meeting, has been that the contractor that the city's going to use to do this work wants to use a hydro shovel, which is a term that I had never heard before, but it's basically like a water shovel to remove some sediment from the structure over the course of doing this work. And I think they were just going to blast it and kind of let the sediment go, but they've since revised that plan so that the sediment is going to be pumped into sediment bags, which will hold the water that are going to be on the shoreline, and that'll hold the matter as the water drains out.
What difference does that make?
One reason that they're doing that, I think, is because there's a hydroelectric plant downstream, like not far from where the dam is, and they are concerned about silt maybe getting in their equipment and stuff. So this sort of mollifies them, and I think also the public was concerned about sediment just going willy-nilly or whatever, and this will be a more controlled way to do it. Another stipulation that DEC may impose is that the city will have to do a fish catch at Ida Lake before
fish catch?
Well, all I know about a fish catch is basically they're going to use volunteers and the city to catch the fish, I guess, in a not kill them, catch them, and then bring them to another space.
We're saving fish.
Yeah, you're saving fish. So there may be opportunities for the public to help out with that. And this sort of ties into one thing that the public was asking about at this meeting, was about, well, why aren't you doing an environmental impact study on this before you start any work? And Chris Whalen said it's not required because it's an emergency project. But they will be required to do one. Basically, no matter what happens, before they do any sort of permanent solution, they will have to do that kind of study. One interesting thing that came up and that there wasn't really an immediate answer for was, so the water level is going to lower once they cut this hole in the dam, right? So this dam is wooden, right? It's going to be exposed. Right now, you can't really see it if you were to go and look at the dam, right? But the level is going to lower, and the water is going to be passing through this. So this sort of wooden structure, skeleton, if you will, is going to be exposed. And Anasha Cummings, the downtown council member, was asking, you know, well, will that mean that twigs and branches and or big branches rather are going to catch more easily on this structure and creating a kind of beaver dam? And that does seem possible. And what the city said they're going to do is have like a, if that does happen, or have a backhoe handy or some kind of equipment handy to be able to remove that stuff. Anasha wasn't quite satisfied with that answer, and Chris Whalen said he was going to follow up on that, because Anasha was basically asking, you know, so this plan is supposed to make the collapse less likely, but what if it's catching more stuff? Yes. And so then that it just might not be
becomes a dam again,
right? So the city did say that, you know, for any answer things that they couldn't answer immediately, and for all answers actually from the public, they're going to post questions and answers on the city's website, the project page that they've set up for this.
That's an interesting question from Anasha. Do you know, is he an engineer?
No, he is not an engineer, but I think he does take an interest in these sorts of projects. So, and he, you know, I don't think he's, I didn't interpret his questions as being sort of, I mean, I think he was skeptical and asking, you know, good questions, but I don't think he was like, don't do this project kind of thing. You know, it wasn't,
he was just
exercising his oversight responsibilities as city council member.
Yeah.
If the city does decide to rebuild the dam, it will not be made of wood. Apparently DEC standards changed and you can't build dams out of wood anymore. They changed about a decade ago. And this dam was built right around the 2000-2001-ish, and it cost a little under $200,000 to build.
I thought you said the dam was 100 years old.
No, there has been a dam there, for 100 years.
Gotcha.
But this dam is only about, you know, 20 years old. So the new structure, if one were to be built, it would be made of concrete and steel and be intended to last a half a century. That's what Chris Whalen said. So a moment ago, I said that the city was doing, they discovered this problem in the beginning because they were preparing to do work on the abutments of the dam. That project is FEMA funded, and the city has this pot of money of a little over $800,000 to do that work. This is sort of funny and kind of surprised me when I heard it when they explained it last week. That money can only be used for the abutments. And some related kind of erosion control work. It can't be used to repair the middle portion of the dam. If the city rebuilds the dam, it forfeits that FEMA money. But if the city decommissions the dam, then with FEMA's approval, they could potentially use that money for another capital project in the city.
Interesting.
That was really strange, and even a member of the public remarked on how strange that was, and the city was sort of like, yeah,
our hands are tied.
Yeah, FEMA, man. Like, I don't. So that was really strange, and that does seem to create an incentive for the city to decommission the dam.
Yeah.
Further incentivizing the city to decommission the dam is that there is apparently DEC grant funding available for dam decommissioning, but there is not DEC funding available, nor is there apparently any federal funding available for dam construction. So again, so the city is unequivocal. Like they say, they have not decided any course of action. And I think there will be more opportunities for public input before they make any sort of final decisions on that.
Do you know offhand why state environmental organization and kind of nationally people are not interested in restoring dams?
You know, that would be an excellent assignment for me in the future. Right. I don't know. No, it's a good question. I honestly don't know, and I didn't look into that. I took Chris Whalen at his word that he had probably, you know,
I'm sure,
looked high and low to see if that, you know, if there were potential, you know, funding opportunities for dam construction. One potential funding partner that has been talked about is that hydroelectric dam. You know, they may have a reason to like, you know, that the way that is. And, you know, maybe there could be, this is just me spitballing here, but, you know, maybe there could be some sort of friends of organization that would coalesce to, you know, there does seem to be quite a bit of neighbors who are really interested in this. And that's really the whole impetus for these monthly meetings was because neighbors were, you know, having so many questions. One question that the city did again try to put to bed at this last meeting was that there's been this persistent rumor that once the dam is, if the dam were to be decommissioned and the pond lowers, that the city would try to sell that land for development. And I just want to read Chris Whalen's quote really, really quickly. That is somebody's imagination. What is in that pond is silt and sediment. If somebody wanted to build there, it's not going to be structurally sound. Okay. So there it is. Maybe it's put to bed now. Maybe it's not. But that's basically the whole meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What else are we recapping on today?
Oh, today. Well, one thing that I discovered just by dumb luck by walking on 3rd Street is that Gina Kim of Sunny's Farm and Kitchen, that the Korean place on Ferry Street downtown, is opening up this new convenience and stationery store. It's kind of right across the street from Dunkin' Donuts. I knew nothing about it. And then I walked by and then today I just walked by and they're like, basically pilot open now.
Whoa.
It still looks like the storefront was I guess maybe a bodega of some sort, you know, from a couple of years ago, but it's been inactive for a while.
Is it on that corner? There is a convenience store.
It's like a storefront or two north of where that convenience store is, right on the corner of Congress there in 3rd. Yeah, it's going to sell like Asian stationery items along with like everyday sort of market convenience store stuff. The back of the space is going to be occupied by a new Vietnamese restaurant launched by Quang Tran, who has been a longtime server at Peck's Arcade. And
wow.
He likened it to a little Asian speakeasy.
Nice.
I don't know what that exactly is. I haven't been, I guess there are some, the speakeasy vibe is something I guess I'm familiar with, right? Like it's kind of, it's in the back,
removed.
You know, sort of removed. Yeah.
Is that something that Gina and Sunny's are partnering on?
Yeah, I think they're basically sharing the space. I don't think Gina is actually involved in the day-to-day or there's just sort of like, you know, sharing space. But I'm sure that's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, different.
Gina is everywhere, I guess. So the IDA last week approved tax breaks for another market rate apartment project on Oakwood Avenue and a final vote on another set of tax breaks for City Station North is scheduled for next month.
Mm.
These are just a couple of quick hit little items. The zoning board of appeals this month did not meet, or they did meet, but they didn't vote on anything because only 3 members of the board came. So
was
everything's tabled for
the
next
weather
month.
Or?
I don't know what the reason was I didn't find that out. There was nothing really big or momentous on the ZBA board. There's only like like 4 or 5 items, so I guess not the worst thing in the world that it was tabled till next month.
Hmm.
Just an update. The county Democrats have been looking to raise the age to purchase tobacco products from 18 to 21.
Hmm.
And it's hasn't passed yet, but it's going to be voted on by a committee, the health committee, on December 5th. And then if it makes it to the floor, the full body is going to vote on it on December 10th.
Hmm.
I'm not sure that it's likely to pass. I think that I don't know that they have much, if any, Republican support, and the legislature is dominated by Republicans. So,
right.
And there have been objections raised. I think one of the main objections is like, well, what will the, you know, fiscal impact be, you know, for sales tax revenue and stuff like that? Or, you know, something to the effect of, why doesn't the state pass it first, you know, or why are we kind of going rogue on this and just being a county? You know, I think other counties have passed it at this point, but nonetheless, it may be unlikely to pass.
That was a Troy News update from Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Physicist and solar boat builder David Borton is back with another installment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. This week, he spoke with Hudson Mohawk correspondent Megan Marone about his ongoing solar boat projects.
We are back with Dr. David Borton, solar boat builder and physicist. Dr. Borton, can you give us an update on the solar boats?
Yes. Well, the 3rd boat, the 44-foot boat, has been tested by the Coast Guard. This was an endurance and sea trial test. The sun was turned off, the solar panels were disconnected, and 3 of the 4 battery banks were disconnected to test how well this would survive in this very much hobbled condition. And it did very well, and so that was a very great day.
On the sea?
Well, on the Hudson River.
Is it a sea vessel, though? It could go on the sea.
It could go on the sea, but the Coast Guard is inspecting it for inland waters.
Okay.
That would include Long Island Sound, the Hudson River, that kind of thing.
But secretly, could you and your wife just take it on a drive and go out to the Atlantic?
Yes, we could take it on the Atlantic and go down the inland waterway, go to Florida, do the Great Loop. That kind of thing would be great fun.
So can you give us a date as to when the people of Troy can see the solar cell 44?
I wish I could. I can't.
Okay. I think that's all the information I'm getting. So last time we were talking about Neil Armstrong. And do you remember in the book of First Man, did he talk about what he ate on his journey?
Yeah, but not a whole lot. You basically mix water with these dry packets and eat them hot or cold.
Just the classic astronaut food.
I believe that's correct.
When I was little, that's all I wanted to try was the astronaut ice cream.
You know, you can get that at backpacking stores.
Yeah. Have you tried it?
Yeah. It's not great, but if you were eating some of the other stuff, it might taste pretty good.
So would Neil Armstrong describe himself as an environmentalist, given what he saw once he got out onto the moon and looked back at planet Earth from that perspective? It's so exciting to think about that.
Well, yes, I think that he recognized looking at the Earth and looking at the Earth's atmosphere, as we said last time, it's this very thin layer of air that is held by gravity to the Earth that keeps us alive. Solar energy comes in, warms up the surface of the Earth, provides all the food, provides distilled water, keeps us alive. So, I'm sure he recognized that and thought about that, but he had so many things to think about in terms of doing his job of flying to the moon, around the moon, landing on the moon, getting back up, that he was very occupied with details of flying to the moon and back.
Right, which is why I would love to read the book. And I appreciate everything you said in the last interview about the details of the pressure on him to hit the right button at the right time to go, you know, from the atmosphere out towards the moon. This is kind of a personal question, but would you say, given that you're trying to educate people about the atmosphere and it's a delicate balance, the sun's energy coming in, the way that that impacts the water cycle and how life works. But would you say just at this stage in humanity with the environmental issues that we're facing that to a certain extent, the work with solar boats and environmental commitment is not only for other people, but also kind of like looking yourself in the mirror and feeling like as a human, you're doing something in the face of climate change?
Yes. You said it was a delicate balance, and that's a very good way of saying it. And so when we change the carbon dioxide concentration in the Earth, we are changing that balance. And changing that balance is something that really affects things.
We know that due to carbon emissions, the atmosphere, well, how would you describe the impact again? Briefly.
Well, let me talk about it in terms of a pot of beans on the stove, okay? If you have a pot of beans in an open pot on the stove and you have it on simmer, and now the pot that I have has a clear lid, and if I put a lid on top of that simmering pot of beans, what happens?
It gets a little hotter.
Yeah, it starts to boil more, okay?
It doesn't just get a little hotter.
Okay, so that's basically what happens when you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere of the Earth. You're putting the lid on the pot and holding more heat in. If you hold more heat in, you get harder boiling, get hotter surface temperatures, that kind of thing.
Because for the sake of the metaphor, the glass lid on the pot is the trapped gases within the atmosphere.
Yeah, the lid just adds another layer of essentially atmosphere holding in the heat on the Earth. And you mentioned it was a delicate balance. So you've now changed the balance. So in fact, more heat is coming in and getting stored on the Earth, and that's causing the oceans to get hotter, the atmosphere to get hotter. And like the pot of beans that boils harder, if you put more energy into the atmosphere, it's going to react to that more energy. It's going to have more energy for bigger storms, more violent storms, more frequent storms, more frequent droughts. So that, yes, that energy actually makes a big difference to the Earth.
So in the summer, when you have the car's windows open, it's warm in the car, but then you roll things up and you're like baking in there.
Yes.
It's a similar
phenomenon. That's another very good example that the window When you roll up a car window, you're changing the window, just like carbon dioxide changes the window of the atmosphere. And if you make that window thicker, more energy, more heat gets trapped. And in the car, it gets hot, hot enough to kill kids, right? And on the Earth, it's getting hot, hot enough to change actually the climate of the Earth.
You know, I think what I love about the solar cell is that one time you and I walked around the steampunk festival and we had a special broadcast of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics at the steampunk festival. And there's a lot of performance at the steampunk festival, people performing their imagination of an alternative reality. And but I think that people have to actually see something different. They have to see a different story. So one of the reasons why people at the steampunk festival like to perform is that they want to feel like they could inhabit for a moment a different Earth. And I think what's so cool about the solar cell is that people actually, when they see it, they actually see a different story.
Well, I like to think so. Yes, you can have solar-powered transportation in boats, and it can be practical. And besides that, it is very pleasant, quiet, there's no smell, there's very little noise. And so, yeah, that's an alternative way to move about the Earth.
I just wish that more people could see different stories, like electric trolley cars. You've talked about the trolley cars that used to be in Troy. Getting back to First Man, though, and Neil Armstrong, is there any relationship in terms of climate change? It's kind of easy to see how the Earth's atmosphere is warming with these trapped gases, and then things are getting to a more rapid boil, like the sea surface temperature rising, and then the storms getting stronger because the ocean surface temperature is just that much hotter. Is there any relationship to the moon, given this First Man cultural moment of the movie coming out? Is there any relationship between the air in the atmosphere and what happens just beyond the atmosphere and that trip to the moon?
Well, yes, space is very, very cold. The moon, where there's no sun shining, is very, very cold. And the sun shining on the astronauts and the LEM, the lunar module that landed, solar energy is very hot. The spacesuits that Neil Armstrong was in actually had to have cooling in them because the sunshine was so hot. Whereas if he had gone and landed on the dark side of the moon, they'd have frozen. So, yes, I would say that's a real connection.
Before this broadcast, you were talking about the amount of air between Earth and the moon.
Yes. Well, have you driven from Troy to Albany?
All my life.
Okay. Well, one-way trip between Troy and Albany, you go through more air than the amount of air between here and the moon.
Why? Why is there so little air?
Because that's all we've got. Gravity holds the air to the surface of the Earth, and there's a little bit of air that holds down the next little bit of air that holds down the next little bit of air, and so there's actually 15 pounds per square inch of air here on the surface of the Earth. But as you go up, you've gone up above some of that air, and then above some more, and above some more, and above some more, and somewhere up there, let's just pick a number, 90 miles, we say there's really no air left, and you're in space.
Wow. So 15 pounds per square inch is the sea that we're swimming in on planet Earth.
Yes. We're okay. Sitting here breathing it and talking through it. And it's all around us. And we don't pay attention to us because, you know, unless there's a hurricane that's blowing that wind so fast, maybe if you're in a sailboat, you notice the wind. But anyway, it's there. And without it, you don't survive.
Do you think if we, this is just a random thought that popped into my head when you said that about sailing and given the solar boat connection too, do you think if we still lived in a culture that was more nautically based, you know, I mean, in the 19th century, we had a more nautically based market world. Do you think that people would pay attention to different environmental issues more?
Yes, if you're nautically based, you have to pay attention to the weather and the environment. Because if you don't, you're probably going to have a problem, a shipwreck or something, and die.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Borton.
It's always a pleasure, Megan. Thank you.
That was the Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Megan Marone with Dr. David Borton as part of their ongoing series, Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
the Museum of Political Corruption is hosting their second annual Nellie Bly Award for Investigative Reporting on Thursday, November 29th in Albany. The museum's founder, Bruce Roeder, joins us now along with Sarah Berger, one of the panelists at the upcoming event. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
So can you briefly tell us who was Nellie Bly and why are they relevant right now?
Well, Nellie Bly was a wonderful pioneering investigative reporter in the late 19th century. She worked down in New York City for Pulitzer's New York World, but she heard that there was corruption up here in Albany. Who would have thought? So she took the train on up here, and she went undercover, pretending to be a lobbyist, because she heard you could basically buy the legislature to pass or kill any bill you wanted. So she wanted to prove it. And she met with this guy named Ed Phelps, who she called the king of the lobbyist. And he took out a piece of paper and said, yeah, I can buy this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. And basically for the price of $1,250, Nellie Bly was able to have a bill killed in the New York State legislature. So we decided we would name this award in her honor. She, of course, didn't accept the money. She went back home and wrote about it.
Right.
But we created this award, and the award is, in fact, for the amount of $1,250.
I love that.
That is very fitting. Yes.
That's wonderful.
And so can you give us a brief description of what exactly the Museum of Political Corruption is and how it came about?
Well, it came about because of my frustration with all of the corruption, all the headlines we had here in Albany several years ago, all with Shelley Silver and Dean Skelos and everybody. And, you know, rather than just throw up my arms and get frustrated, I thought, you know, I'm an educator, I'm a professor at St. Rose. I thought, we really need to do something about this. We need to learn about this, educate ourselves. So the idea came up for a museum of political corruption, and it seems to have been a unique idea. And the more I discussed this with other people, the more the light bulbs just started to go off and saying, yeah, you could do this and this. And then we became a real organization and a nonprofit, and we got our New York State charter. And so we're rolling, and we're looking for a venue right now in downtown Albany, and things are going well.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. What kinds of things would you see in a museum of political corruption? I assume most of this stuff in history has been kind of handshakes and stuff like that, right?
You'll see plenty of handshakes and kickbacks and loopholes. And you'll see a perpetual revolving door in the lobby of lobbyists. And we will have a hall to go over the history of corruption in New York State, which is a fascinating story. It's a great history. We'll also have a hall called Solutions Hall, which will offer solutions to people, or it will even ask museum goers what they think their solutions should be for solving corruption. We'll have the Cozy Crony Cafe, of course, and we'll have the Tammany Lecture Hall for lectures. And so we're going to have a lot of wonderful programming going on there.
And can you tell us who's receiving the award this year?
The award this year is going to the fabulous reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey of the New York Times for their reporting on Harvey Weinstein and all of that did to completely break open the Me Too movement this year.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. And so... Moving over to Sarah, we had a couple questions for you. How did you get involved with this award, the Nellie Bly Award?
Well, I think it was my dear friend Susan Arbetter that may have put a bug in Bruce's ear, although I'm not sure.
More than a bug, yes.
So I'm an attorney locally in the Capital Region. I actually just opened my own law firm, decided that it was time. In fact, it was probably long overdue. So I'm based out of Saratoga Springs, which is where I grew up. And I also have an office in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a licensed attorney in both states. And my practice centers around the representation of individual employees in discrimination, retaliation type lawsuits, including sexual harassment. In fact, part of my inspiration for opening my own firm was the Me Too movement. And I want to help women advance their careers in particular. So, I mean, even within my office, I think women in the legal profession have their own challenges with respect to being able to start families and balance work life. And so anyway, that's a little bit about me.
But, oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
I was going to say you were also appointed city attorney in Saratoga. Is that correct? But stepped down shortly after?
That's correct. I was the first female and to date the only woman to serve in that position.
But what can you tell us what the short length of the tenure was about?
In sum and substance, as an attorney, I felt that the city council did not want me to do my job as an attorney, and what they really wanted me to do was to help advance their political interests. And I felt that the politics was overwhelming and really got in the way of the job as it should be. And I felt very strongly about doing things the right way. I'm a person that prides myself on standing on my principles. And when I resigned, actually, my resignation letter to the mayor stated that I was resigning due to a, quote, fundamental disagreement in the handling of the city's legal matters. And I think that actually was probably the nicest and most diplomatic way I could put it.
Right.
Without pointing any fingers at anyone or, you know. Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like your foray into politics really put you much closer in line with Bruce's line of thinking than it maybe had previously, huh?
Yeah, I think so. That's probably a fair statement. And then I decided the following year to do another first, and I was the first woman to run for Commissioner of Public Safety in the city of Saratoga Springs as well. In fact, I ran as a Democrat in a Democratic primary, challenging my own party and sort of bucking the system. I lost the primary, but I don't regret anything that I did or said, and I think we ran a great campaign, and I'm hoping to run again maybe someday soon.
And so for the moment, is it more of just focus on the legal practice then?
Absolutely, yes.
As well as giving out some wonderful awards.
Yeah. And sitting on a fantastic roundtable.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's an absolute honor to be part of this panel, and I'm looking forward to the event.
Are there any other local notables who will be participating in the roundtable?
Oh, absolutely. We've got a wonderful panel in store. It includes Assemblywoman Pat Fahey and former mayor of Saratoga Springs, Joanne Yepsen, who is going to be the moderator of the panel. We're also bringing up Alexis Grinnell from New York to be a part of the panel, as well as Barb Bartoletti, who was the former legislative director for the League of Women Voters in Albany. So it should be a fascinating event. And this all takes place when? On Thursday, November the 29th, a week from Thanksgiving. It starts at 6 o'clock. And yeah, and this is at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany, across from the downtown SUNY campus. So it should be a great time.
How could they find out more information? A website or anything like that?
Right. This is all on our website, of course, which is www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org. Yeah.
You know, that really sounds like an institution that could be expanded nationally. Well, I could certainly see offices in Chicago, in D.C., of course.
I've been getting calls. Oh, absolutely. People have been reaching out to me worldwide about this museum. And I tell them, look, we're going to build it here in Albany first, and then we're going to franchise to the rest of the world. But let's make this a model, and let's make Albany a model for ethical governance and ethical leadership with a museum like this. That's what we're all about.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It sounds so exciting. You both sound so animated about the event. What in particular are you each looking forward to next week?
Well, I think for me, I always, whenever I sit on a panel, I really enjoy meeting my co-panelists. Of course, I know a few of them, including my former boss and friend, Mayor Yepsen. I think for me, that's always the best part, is the people that you meet, the people that come in to see the event. Because at the end of the day, that is what it's all about, people and relationships.
I think me too. Look, me too. yeah, this is our second go around. And I can tell you last year's experience was just amazing. We gave the award to Suzanne Craig of the New York Times, who came up here with a few of her New York Times buddies. And we had an amazing panel discussion. And I was like sitting in the audience in awe of all of this and just bringing these brilliant people together to talk about a particular subject was really fascinating, and everybody had a magnificent time.
And so, you know, just one more time for the people who didn't catch it at the beginning, can you tell us what the event is and where they can go to find out more?
Absolutely. It's the second annual award of the Nellie Bly Award for Investigative Reporting, and it's going to be on Thursday the 29th at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany, 405 Washington Avenue. It starts at 6 p.m., and you can find out more information, including tickets, at our website, which is www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org.
Thank you very much. And Sarah, where can people get a hold of you? Do you have a social media presence of any kind?
I do. My new law firm website is still under construction, but it is there, burgerlawgroup.com. I'm also on Facebook under my name, Sarah Berger, and LinkedIn as well.
Well, fantastic. Thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Bruce Roeder, founder of the Museum of Political Corruption, and Sarah Berger, who is on the panel for their upcoming Nellie Bly Award for Investigative Reporting. The event is Thursday, November 29th at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany. Visit museumofpoliticalcorruption.org for more information.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Kleanna Lightborn. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Dan Pfeiffer now joins us for a live data justice interview with Gina Kim and Alan Tan from the American Civil Liberties Union. Note that Gina shares the same name as Gina Kim from Sun Hees, who Luke spoke about earlier in the show, not the same person. Take it away, Dan.
Hello. Yeah, I have two of my colleagues from the ACLU here in the studio today, Gina Kim and Alan Tan. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. So our team is pretty new, created at the beginning of 2018. And I was wondering, how do you describe what we do to other people?
Yeah, so we are part of a wave of people that came in after the 2016 presidential election, and a lot of us are new to both the nonprofit world as well as the more political, like activism or legal worlds. And we're part of a strategy that the organization decided in 2016, when people suddenly began donating to the ACLU much, you know, at a much larger rate, and and we decided that the organization wanted to become more involved in defending civil liberties, not just in the courts, but also providing people who are motivated to become more politically active to help them have the information and tools to do that. So we are, as a team, thinking about how we can do that.
Yeah, and the ACLU does a lot of things. There are a lot of services that they provide, and we just want to make sure that we meet users, whether they are folks visiting our site or people who know about it, people who don't know about it. We just want to make sure that they know what they are and they have a good reach to it.
And I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but Gina and Alan are both designers, and our team builds a lot of web stuff, and I'm a software developer, so a lot of our work is me taking designs that they've created and turning them into websites. Gina, you've also done a lot of user research to find out how people actually interact with those websites. Do you have any surprising discoveries that you found by talking to people who use our websites?
Yeah, so just to backtrack a little bit, user research is kind of understanding what people do, how they behave, and really understanding what their needs are. And I think what's been surprising through the process is just understanding the spectrum of users we have. I think when I first joined, I thought of donors because, you know, I'm a donor and I was like, oh, what does the ACLU do? But then it's not just the donors. There are a lot of people who are visiting the ACLU website for the first time. There are journalists, there are other academics, lawyers coming in to get information from our resources. So I think just understanding that we have this large spectrum of users has been surprising for me.
So we just finished up with the midterm elections, and we worked on a project called ACLU Voter. And Alan was the designer on that project, and I thought maybe you could talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, that was one of the first projects our team worked on, and in collaboration with folks in the political advocacy side of things, as well as the folks in the editorial team and communications team. It was really a like all hands on deck project for the organization. Because there were so many different teams involved, the project that we worked on was meant to be a place where all of that work could be housed and information could be presented to people, both, you know, really basic stuff that you'll see a lot of other sites were providing before the election, like when to vote, where to go vote, as well as things that only the ACLU was doing, like races that we really cared about winning and making sure people understood the stakes at, for. There were two ballot initiatives in particular I'll mention that the organization put a lot of money into, like doing raising awareness around. There was a sanctuary law in the state of Oregon that there was a ballot referendum to try to repeal that sanctuary law status. The law was mainly a way to prevent police from just pulling over people that they suspected were undocumented immigrants without, you know, any cause. You know, they weren't necessarily breaking the law. They were just there was just suspicion, and so the argument was that that repealing that sanctuary law was not preventing police from doing their jobs in terms of protecting people from crime or anything like that. It was purely and simply like something that was meant to stoke fear of immigrants. So we won that ballot initiative. Yay!
Yay!
And actually, out of the 10 ballot initiatives that the organization got involved in, we won 7 of them. So the site was one of the big places where we were sending people to when we were we had lots of volunteers across the country texting and calling people to tell them about ballot initiatives in their state, and we were directing people to the site to learn more about what to vote for and what to care about.
And tell us about ballot amendment 4 in Florida, which I think is probably the second one.
Yes, that was right. I was
another big win for us.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that was another huge one. And whereas Oregon was about protecting rights, in Florida it was a chance to give people restore rights for many people. The ballot initiative was to allow and make sure people who had been convicted but had served their sentences to allow, make sure they could vote. So people who had, you know, repaid their debt to society, they, you know, should be able to represent themselves and have a voice in our society. So as a result of that ballot initiative passing, 1.4 million people now can vote in Florida.
Yeah, that's huge. This is Dan Pfeiffer, and if you're just joining us, I'm chatting with my colleagues Gina Kim and Alan Tan from the American Civil Liberties Union. Gina, I know that you've been doing some research on updating the part of our website called Know Your Rights. What has been your approach for doing that?
Yeah, so we were asked to redesign the pages existing today. You could see the current version today on ACLU.org. But we wanted to take a step back to do what we call a discovery phase, where we talk to users, show some of the early stages of what we're working on first, and get their feedback so we could kind of iterate and improve on it step by step instead of kind of just making everything first and then asking them. So one of the first major things we noticed was a lot of the Know Your Rights content was strictly legalistic, and it was coming from lawyers, but it was a little hard to understand, and we wanted to put that in plain language. So we went through our first batch, put it in front of people who went through the issues that we have online and asked, you know, how they interpret the information, if it was easy to find. And we were asking them a lot about it. And there are a couple of things we learned. We do a great job putting showing users what their rights are, but users wanted to know what they can do with that. So one of the things was, for example, under gender harassment in workplace, one of the things, actions we had in our content for what you do when your rights were violated, we had an advice for, you know, go to the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And a user said, that is not something I would do right away if I saw something like that. That's really scary and daunting, so I might not do anything at all. So we got a lot of questions of, is there any way we can talk to people at work? Can I talk to my manager? What are these kind of gradual escalation points without having to do something that, you know, takes a lot out of people? First stop by police, we've put our content in front of people, and you know, that's a very sensitive topic, and there's a lot happening today. And for those who are at risk, that's a harder thing to just take, because many times rights are violated. So we put content around how to stay safe and how to manage risk when you're in that situation. And we just want to make sure that people are prepared and know kind of what is happening today, so that they can make the decision of how they would handle that situation.
And I noticed in the designs that there's also a section about how, as a bystander, you can do your best to ensure someone's civil liberties aren't being violated. So I don't know, like, what are some of the other, like, prompts on that section, for example?
Yeah, so under any situation you might click on, let's say, like ICE showed up at your door. We have kind of these different headers that talk about, you know, how to stay safe in this situation, what are your rights, what it might look like if your rights were violated. And also, you know, if you're a bystander at kind of a point where someone's being victimized, how you can act. And this goes back to the learning that he asked about before. What are, you know, what's surprising for you? And we learned that, again, who these different users are, and it's not necessarily always the victims who are the ones looking at this content. It's also understanding who you might be, if you're a person of privilege to help somebody in a situation, and just also letting people know how you could educate yourself when it's not necessarily even your rights being violated, but someone else's right being violated.
Yeah, I think because of the most recent election, a lot of people were kind of like becoming political for the first time, maybe, or wanting to find ways to help. And often those are people with the most privilege in society who their bubble kind of popped for the first time. And so we wanted to take this as a chance to reach out to those people directly and, you know, have them help the rest of us who are, you know, at more risk.
I know, like, recently we got an email from our website analytics saying that the Know Your Rights about how to go to a protest safely had suddenly got a lot of visitors, and we realized that it was because, like, a Reddit thread had linked to our webpage, and suddenly a lot of people were coming from Reddit to ACLU.org. What are some other ways that you think people might be discovering ACLU type information or have ACLU concerns that could be met outside of just, like, a website or a physical printed pamphlet?
Yeah, I think there are a few different ways. We just as a part of before redesigning the Know Your Rights site, we had put out a lot of printed material, and there was a big effort to redesign that work. A lot of that gets handed out at events as well as protests. We are very proactive both online and on social media, where if we know a protest is happening, we are posting that content online, and you don't have to go to the website directly, but you can just see that information on Facebook or on Twitter.
Yeah, and just to add, that kind of information is really helpful for us as kind of the product, you know, tech designers, engineers, just to observe and see when are those points when those materials are needed and how we could improve upon that.
Yeah, I think there's often a chance when, because Know Your Rights is often very broad in general, there's a very easy chance for us to forget about it or not update it as much as we should. And that's always a good reminder for us to take a look at that again.
So I think we have time for one more question. Around Troy and the broader Capital District, I would say that police brutality and immigration are the two civil rights, civil liberties issues that have gotten the most attention. What would you say are the best ways for people to get involved who are listening?
Yeah, kind of like what I mentioned before of kind of, it's kind of this moment to kind of educate ourselves, to understand what other people's rights are and what your rights are, understanding your privilege and other privileges that other people might not have. I think it's kind of taking that in, understanding that, and there's this opportunity to have empathy towards other people and just put yourself in that situation and know what that would be like. And, you know, maybe it's practicing that, maybe it's role playing, I don't know, but there are many ways to kind of, again, be equipped to know what happens when someone else is in trouble and how you can help them out.
Yeah, and I think if you don't know anyone who has been personally experiencing those issues, that's a good chance or maybe a good reminder to talk to more people and to reach out to try to get a better understanding of what people are going through.
Thanks so much, Gina and Alan. It's really good to talk to you on the radio.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Dan Pfeiffer interviewing the ACLU's Gina Kim and Alan Tan. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Kleanna Lightborn. Our engineer tonight is Jack Massaroni. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.